Welcome to the Disruptive Entrepreneur Podcast.
What does the word disruptive mean to you?
It means going beyond the ordinary, going beyond the status quo.
Not thinking in the conventional way, not just sort of following the herd.
Disruptive means shaking things up, you know?
Disruptive entrepreneur is somebody who sees the problem and embraces the problem with a new way.
Shake up and awakening.
Quality will take care of itself, and you'll go from being disruptive but also profitable.
When you use your own reservoir of talent, when you love what you do, then you disrupt.
Mix it up, change it up, and dominate.
And now, your host, 8 times best-selling author and double world record holder, Rob Moore.
Hi, it's Rob Moore here. I am host of the Disruptive Entrepreneur Podcast. I do a few other things on the side, as it were, and I'm here with Phil Graham.
Thank you, my man. How are you?
Phil, I think it's fair to say we're mutual fans of each other's work.
Thank you very much. A mutual fan of yours too. Massive inspiration. You're doing a ton of incredible work. Love it.
Thank you. So we decided we'd do a little bit of a collaboration.
We did.
I have some questions for you. You have some questions for me.
I do indeed.
Hopefully a bit of something comes out that maybe we didn't expect as well. So I want to start, Phil, with your story, because I know you're not just a guy in fitness.
Yep.
I know that actually you started with a real drive and a real purpose, and there was something that went on in your life that I think really made you on mission.
Yep, massively. Yep.
I think there's a lot of people that they're PTs or they're business owners, but they don't really know why, and they don't really have a mission, and they're not really clear on what their vision is, and I think you are.
Yeah, very much so.
So tell us your story.
It all started back when I was 16 years of age.
And how old are you now?
I'm 31 now, just turned 31, and I was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes. I'll not go into the whole story, but long story short, when you're told that you're going to die younger and you're going to have a lot of health complications if you don't look after it, it's a pretty big kick in the ass to start looking after yourself. Mm. And I remember the very minute that I was diagnosed, I was marched down this cold clinical corridor into, if you imagine, one of those really cold clinical rooms. And there's pictures of hearts and physiology all over the wall and just really traumatic stuff about diabetes complications. So I was 16 years of age, I was marched into this room, and I was literally told that I was going to have years taken off my life and that I wasn't going to be able to have a normal life. Now, a lot of the wording that I heard from the healthcare professional was could, might, possibly, there may be the potential of. And I found a lot of inspiration in that. I realized there was nothing being said that was definite. And out of all of that, that gave me hope. And then I listened very carefully to some of the main areas that I could control. And nutrition, fitness, mindset, medication, and lifestyle were those words. So immediately after that, I took it upon me to really learn as much as I could about those particular areas. And my dream was to become a dietitian. I wanted to work in the healthcare service, and I was inspired to look at all this stuff because it was allowing me to live longer. So I began to learn about it, I began to know about it, and I started training. And I very quickly, with that knowledge, was able to build a great physique, and I found a love for bodybuilding. Cut a long story short, I took a bodybuilding career and I competed all over the world and won many shows from Junior Mr. Northern Ireland, Junior Mr. Ireland, right the whole way through to competing on the stage in Junior Mr. Universe, Junior Mr. Britain, and I really found something that I loved.
I'm feeling Junior Mr. Inadequate sitting next to you.
I'm retired now.
Junior Mr. Matchstick.
but with that, I was really inspired to train and look after my health, the very thing that had been taken from me. And because I was engrossed in the information and I was reading so much about it, I was equipped with a lot of knowledge. So a lot of people caught on to what I was doing. They saw the transformation. They saw what I was doing. They saw the trophies that I was winning and all the competitions. And they began to ask me, how do you get in shape? How do you do this? How do you do that? So that knowledge from being diagnosed with diabetes, I then was able to leverage into a personal training business. Long story short, I did very well as a personal trainer, built a very profitable personal training business, leveraged that into an online personal training business back when online had only just started. And I began to have a lot of fitness professionals look at me as almost like a go-to. You've got the knowledge and you've built the business. Mm-hmm. So a lot of personal trainers came to me and began to ask, how do I get more clients? How do I drive my authority? How do I build my brand? And then I began to coach coaches. And on top of that, at the same time, coach them on the aspects of all the technicals of nutrition and training. So I had a very diversified kind of client. I had general pop that I was coaching to get lean and fit and strong. And then I had the coaches. And then I remember one year, because I used to travel and speak at exhibitions all over the world, I used to talk a lot about nutrition and training. And one day after an event at a big expo in Birmingham, Body Power Expo, there was a queue of people queuing up. and a large proportion of them were diabetic. And one person said to me in that queue, you really need to do something with all that knowledge that you've acquired for people with diabetes. And that inspired me to go and write the Diabetic Muscle and Fitness Guide, which is the world's best-selling book on diabetes and muscle building. We created a massive community with that. Online resources, online membership site, online coaching. We had dietitians involved, and we created a large movement for men and women that wanted to build a great physique with diabetes, because it's so hard if you don't have the technical knowledge. So we built that on top of all the coaching, the coaches, and then the personal training, which is now leveraged. So, you know, a big, big lesson from that was going from one-to-one to one-to-many, but I wouldn't be where I am now without that adversity in my life. And the diabetes has fueled that. And diabetes has never taken up any time and space in my mind, and really haven't been resentful of it. I've been very, very grateful of it. And that's a very powerful thing. It's liberated me from actually letting it rule me. And it's an area of my life that I took ownership with. And I think there's a huge, huge lesson in that. And that's it.
Okay, so there's about three or four things I think we could dive into story. Before we do, I want to share with you some of the stuff I think we're going to talk about so you know what's coming, because we're probably going to do another at least 45 minutes here. So we could talk about the wealth building and mindset side of being a personal trainer in the fitness business. It will help for general wealth building, but specifically for personal trainers. I think young people need to think a bit older, because I think a lot of people are just looking to get paid this week or this
very
month
much so, yep.
rather than building long-term wealth. We'll talk about mindset and money, managing your emotions, scaling up, how to get noticed in a very crowded market.
Yep.
Let's be honest, things like personal training, online training, being a coach or a mentor, they're quite crowded. How to leverage social media, face-to-face versus online, imposter syndrome, how to stay sharp, how to avoid burnout.
Yep.
That's just a few things on my list, Phil.
Very much so.
Something you said, which I think people need to hear. I think there's a lot of people who are experiencing pain in their life, and their pain is beating them down, whether it's depression, anxiety, bad financial situation, bad relationship situation, and they're looking at the pain as the problem.
Yep.
Whereas what you did was the opposite. You looked as the pain as the driver,
the fuel.
Yep. Exactly. And we both have a mutual mentor, Dr. John DeMartini, and he taught me that voids create values, i.e. many people's highest values in life, the things that they live for the most and identify with and strive towards, are created by the voids that they have.
Yep.
So Oprah Winfrey was abused, she was raped. I don't know if you remember the story of Abraham Lincoln. I mean, two of his children died. He failed and he failed and he failed and he failed. And I think he was age 52 when he became president, when the average life expectancy was age 35.
Yep.
And the founder of Alcoholics Anonymous was a previous alcoholic. Yep. So I think the lesson I'm getting from you that I think is really important for everyone, whether it's health and fitness, personal training, or any business, is use your pain as your progress, as your purpose, because we all have pain. And if you turn it into something meaningful and it's a void, but you try and fill it with good instead of it creating this empty hole in your life, which sucks everything in. Because every successful person I've met, like I know quite a few billionaires, I've met a lot of successful people. They have pain, they have issues, they have shit that's gone in their life. A lot of people say to me, well, Rob, it's hard for me at the moment. And I look at the situation, I think, I know loads of people who it's a lot harder for than you. I don't say it to them in that way because that's not sensitive.
Well, it's a perception, right? And it's just clouded. And I mean, the big, big thing about finding an area of your life that you're not doing well in or you're challenged by is looking at it, finding the right people to ask for help, and just taking action and prioritizing. And a big thing for me was realizing that those areas of my life, the nutrition, the training, the lifestyle, the mindset, were areas that where I was lacking. So the first thing I did was try to master those areas by learning and taking action and understanding that it wasn't going to happen overnight. I was consistent, methodical, I had a plan, I kept myself accountable. Those are all specific traits of how to get out of a problem. And any area of your life that you're challenged with is an area that you need to improve. You find somebody that's done very, very well in it, you get accountable, and you just take action. And sometimes that action does have to be a little bit blind. You just have to lean into it and get on with it.
Or painful.
Or painful, and you have to build momentum with it over time. And, you know, I think that's a big, big void with so many people in the fitness industry trying to build a fitness business or any business. They see people that are really successful, they feel disempowered, they get either jealous or they minimize themselves, and the first thing they do is just sit and feel sorry for themselves. Whereas looking at, right, what has that person done? What traits have they got? What things have they mastered? What areas? What do I need to do? And just getting started. And that's a huge, huge thing. It's getting momentum and building it and building it, celebrating the wins along the way and keeping accountable and getting some pressure. And accountability should hurt. Accountability should hurt. It should hurt to a degree financially. It should hurt to a degree where you get called out on your BS. And it should get, you know, literally, you have to use a lot of energy and you have to put yourself in situations that you're not comfortable with. So I always say to people, when you're trying to do something new, like build a new business or do something, it's like lifting weights for the first time. The first time you go in, the coordination's all over the place and everything else, and it's sore. But as you get more conditioned to it, it becomes much, much more easier and much, much more routine, and it builds over time. And then it's just about layering it up and periodizing it, taking on bigger challenges to create a bigger adoption.
I mean, people in the fitness and personal training space, they should be able to get their head around this, because let's be honest, most people who are PTs or in fitness, they like a bit of pain. They love a bit of pain in the gym. That next day body ache, or that 3 day body ache, they actually love that.
Exactly,
there's some sadomasochism about that. So you can transmute that into the business area. And I think, Phil, when I asked you upstairs, you know, what do you want to talk about today? Because we wanted to make sure we merged our worlds. One of them was the wealth and business building side of being a PT. And I see loads of coaches, consultants, trainers, PTs, you know, all, in anything really, they're one man bands. And they're interested in the thing that they're teaching. And they get accreditation and qualification and they get good at that. But they don't embrace sales, marketing, scaling up, hiring, tax, accountancy, finance, all of that stuff, because that's not really what they want to do. If they wanted to do that, they'd have learned that at school and done economics. And the reality is, if you want to go from a one-man band personal trainer who's shouting at people all day, every day, which might be fun, but it's not scalable, how many of those sessions can you do a day? And so you've got a limit to what you can earn. And when you're 18 years old and you're earning 500 quid a week, you think, I'm made. But like, £1 million is not a lot of money now. It is not a lot of money.
The big thing is that you get bored very quick. When you're doing a business model that can't scale, you're not going to be able to sustain that for long because it's going to get very boring. And when you're bored as an entrepreneur, then you start looking around and start chasing shiny objects. You start comparing yourself. And then you're caught in this trap of, right, how do I go to the next level? And sometimes to go to the next level, you have to take a little bit of a dip in finance to sometimes create something to bring you to the next. Or you have to lean into an area where you're incompetent. And that takes, again, repetition to build skill, to build confidence, and then to eventually crack it. So there's a lot of elements to that.
Okay, so you wanted to talk to me about PT scaling up and building wealth and having a longer term mindset, I suppose. So I'm all yours for that, if you want to discuss that.
A big, big thing about the fitness industry, personal trainers and gym owners, is it's a really dense market. There's more and more people now that are overweight, so there's a large demand for the service. But a lot of people that suddenly go to the gym and get in shape, fall in love with weight training, fall in love with nutrition, then want to create a business out of it. And I think there's a big difference between having a passion for something and turning it into a business that you can make money out of and fuel your lifestyle and your family with. And I think a big, big confusion lies with a lot of people that start out as a personal trainer or gym owner. They don't know what to expect from the business side of things, and they're just good at the technical aspects, and they don't realize all the hats they have to wear with marketing, with sales, with accountancy. And as a result of that, it can get very overwhelming. And that is why so many personal trainers fall out of the industry, because they don't equip themselves with what's to come. It's almost like a dream job to get paid to do the very thing that got you in shape. And that's why so many personal trainers go into it, because they've got into shape themselves or experienced some kind of value out of health and fitness, and they want to share it with the world, but they just don't know how to scale it. And there are a number of ways that you can do that. As a personal trainer, you could go into online coaching, you could look at setting up a gym. There's a ton of different ways. But most fitness entrepreneurs don't have a vision for what they're wanting to do in 3, 5, or 10 years. And as a result, they just focus on the week to week, and they get very overwhelmed, or they get caught up in just working time for money, and then they get burnt out. So if you really want to have a vision, you've got to focus on how can I work from one to one to one to many. And that doesn't necessarily mean coaching a large group. It's how can you systemize your business to help more than one person? How can you automate it but still keep empathy in there and touch points in there? How can you delegate things that you don't like to do? How can you charge more money for a particular service when you're undercharging? So there's a lot of different dynamics to it, and they have to ask themselves questions periodically. And so many personal trainers and gym owners, they won't reflect on the progress that they've had. And it's almost just like a sprint, and they're not stopping and reevaluating. And I'm massive into previewing and reviewing progress and looking what worked, what didn't work, what people need to do more of, what they need to do less of, and as well as building that into a strategic life plan. Because I think this is a big, big thing with a lot of young entrepreneurs in any space. It's just all financially focused. And it's just focused on a set target and a set number. And we both know people that are very wealthy that are extremely unhappy. And a lot of people set that finance as a metric of their success or their happiness. And once they get there, they will be happy. But it's not linked into anything, or they don't have a clear why. If you want to hit $1 million a year, why do you want to do that? What is that going to enable you to do? And when you start asking people those questions, there's no substance to that. And it's just a figure for egotistical sake. And they're just trying to impress people that they don't like. Mm. So it's, you know, how do we build an actual life vision, a life plan, and tie in the business around that and get really clear on how do we want to spend our day? How do we want to run our business? Who do we want to work with? Who do we not want to work with? What kind of money do we want to make? Where do we want to put that money? How do we want to invest it? And how do we want to spend it? And those kind of things are sound really, really simple, but not a lot of people build that into their actual strategic planning for business. And then they get overwhelmed, and then their brain doesn't know where they're going, and that's why they complain about being burnt out.
Yeah.
You know, if you've got a vision, you will work through any challenge in your life to get through to that because you're very clear on it. And that's why you get a lot of personal trainers burning out and falling out of the industry. Like the stats are super, super high because they don't have a long-term vision and they're just financially focused, or they're just trying to get, you know, as much money in as short space of time as possible. And, you know, that's there's a lot of pitfalls with that.
Mm. So I've got a couple of thoughts on something you said there, Phil, about burnout. Because I don't think people really understand what burnout is. Because I think some people think they're burned out when they're not. I think some people don't know when they're burned out when they are. So you need some self-awareness to know what your body really is telling you.
Yep.
But I would argue this. No one is burned out doing what they love, no matter how hard they do it. So do you see David Goggins going, oh man, I'm burned out doing these like 200 mile runs? Because he's doing what he loves.
Yep, exactly.
So burnout is not from overwork.
Yep.
I really believe this because if you look at all the people at say Harvard University or the great schools around the world that became people like Einstein or Tesla or you know, all these amazing people who changed the world or people who eradicated various diseases or illness or won Nobel Prizes, they're the ones with the lights on at 3 o'clock in the morning when everyone else's lights are off. So, you know, Mark Zuckerberg, imagine him as an 18, 19 year old in his dorm just coding all night. These guys aren't burned out.
Yeah.
And Warren Buffett's not burned out. And he reads annual reports for 6 hours a day and he's not burned out. So if you think you're burned out, you're probably doing something you don't love to do, being forced to do it by someone who you maybe don't respect or admire. Of course, there's general energy management, there's diet, and I do believe that has a part to play. But I can go a long time working a lot of hours.
We still have a lot of like really successful people that are bad dads that keep going all night long, though.
True. Yeah, I mean, because when you're obsessive, maybe you don't know when the off button is, and that is a good point. But I think when you're on mission and on path, and by the way, to be on mission and on purpose is quite easy to do. You just ask yourself every single day, what am I supposed to do with my life and why am I supposed to do it? What am I supposed to do with my life and why am I supposed to do it? And you can't expect to answer it today or tomorrow. You might get lucky. Some people know what they want to, like we were talking about Rory McIlroy. That is pretty early on clear. And that's obvious now that that's his thing. But many of us, we don't know till we're 20 or 30 or 40 or 50. But I got lost between 18 and 25 in my life, financially, emotionally, directionally, career. Because I just, in that whole 7 years, I didn't ask myself once, what do I want to do with my life?
And I think that's a really important point on that, is that not many people stop and ask themselves that question because they think it's airy-fairy or what it's going to lead to, or they just haven't asked it before. But when you truly ask
it for 5 minutes a day
and get clear all the time, like evaluating in your head, am I doing what I love? What could I be doing better? What do I need to delegate? And I think on that, is so many entrepreneurs struggle to delegate because they built the very business that they have now and the success with their own hard work and ethic, and they're scared to let it go. Or they don't know how to. They don't know how to like alleviate that control, or they're scared of somebody messing up. And I think one of the biggest myths in entrepreneurship and building a business is nobody will do it quite like yourself. If you have created the right systems, the right passover, you've let people made mistakes and you've refined it and tweaked it and communicated the how and the why, and condition that over time, you can pass a lot of stuff off. And John DeMartini said to me, and it's something that really struck out, you cannot lead an inspiring life if you don't delegate. And that's something that I think you have to learn the hard way. You have to be doing something until you get that frustrated or that close to burnout that you just have to learn, how can I pass this off? And I think a lot of people fail because they fear they're losing money when they delegate. and they're not clear on how to delegate something, and the business has built momentum and they're scared to stop or take a step back.
Because they don't want to lose the money. The client, they feel that the clients need them. There's a bit of an ego thing going on. Everyone likes me. I'm the face of it all. So I think if you're a one-man band, I know we're talking a lot about the fitness industry. If you're a one-man band, I think get into your business and think, okay, how can I replace myself as quickly as possible? How can I get out of the business? And it sounds counterintuitive to a lot of people to talk about or think about getting out of their business before they've even got in their business. So I wrote a book called Life Leverage, and I talk about the whole process. But essentially what happened to me was I built a company. I became a millionaire between the age of 30 and 31. And I started at maybe 25, 26. 26 maybe. So I did it fairly quickly. And by the time I was, 32, I had a company turning over a few million quid, and I had a property portfolio, and I loved my life and I loved my business. I was with my girlfriend, who's now my wife, and I worked hard and I wore it like a badge of honor. You know, like, no one works harder than me. I get in earlier, I start, you know, I stay later, and I wore it like a badge of honor. And my son was born, I was 32, and for the first 9 months of his life, I worked all day, every day, like I was before he was born, because I loved my job. Now, some people work because they have to work. I feel very fortunate. I was working because it was my company and I loved it, and I was making a difference, and I was writing books. And then my wife sat me down, then not my wife at the time, she was my girlfriend then, and she said, "Rob, it's great what you do, and I'm really proud of you. But if you keep this up, when your son's 18 and he leaves home, you will have no idea who he is, because you won't see him. Because he's 9 months old and you don't see him."
So that actually leads me to a really, really important question that I have, that's like a dying question, and I'm sure it's a question that so many people have, is like, as a fast-paced entrepreneur who's really focused on their vision and their mission and doesn't slow down, how do you build a really healthy marriage and bring up a family as well? Like, if we separate,
I'm glad you didn't start with that question.
First of all, if we start with the marriage, right, and then we'll start with, you know, bringing up kids, and that's an area of my life that I haven't moved into yet. I don't have kids, but hearing it from you, like golden piece of advice, marriage, golden piece of advice, kids, like, what would that be? Because like, you're in a position to advise on it, so I'd love to hear that. So marriage, let's go with marriage first. Let's go with the hardest one.
Okay, so I think any relation, like, I want to make a caveat here. I'm very comfortable talking about business, money, mindset, etc., property. I'm a bit less comfortable talking about marriage advice.
Yeah, but
and I know he's fucking live in the hour as well.
But it's all part of it, though.
Yeah, it is. I perceive myself as a student, not a master. When it comes to marriage, yes, I'm married. And I've been with my wife 12 years, and we've got a good, strong relationship. I just thought I'd make that caveat in case people start thinking that Rob's spinning out marriage advice. Okay, so you know, when you go through a relationship that's 10 years longer, I think you go through different cycles, and I think the key to making it sustain would be A, to both be bought into the mission. When my wife met me, she was, I mean, she's attracted more by my ambition than she is by my looks, I can tell you that. Because whenever she says what she likes about me, which is about once every 3 years or so, Phil.
I'm always told the same. I'm punching off. Every time I put a photo up underneath it, it's like, you're punching. I get it too.
So she tells me that she likes my ambition.
Yeah.
So when we met, I wasn't made. Yeah. I mean, I don't say that I'm made now, but I'm more made. So she knew what she was getting into. And so that was clear. And I think that's what she wanted for her life.
Yep.
And I was very clear with her, like, I'm on this mission. And I'm with you, but I'm also on this mission.
Yeah.
And I'd had a girlfriend before her who really wasn't on board with my mission, and it just didn't work out. So I think on board with the mission. Now, that you don't always get lucky and meet people and you're on board with the mission straight away. And sometimes you've been in a career for 10 years and then you quit to be a personal trainer. So what you have to do is sit down with your partner, husband or wife, and talk about the mission and talk about the plan.
Like, here's what I'm going to do.
Well, here's what we're going to do. Really important. So when I sat down with Gemma every now and again to talk about the mission, it's like, what's Gemma's role in it? What role does she want in it? Because she worked for me for 5 years and then she wanted to be like operationally involved in the mission. And then she quit, actually, because we had young kids and she decided she didn't want to do that anymore. And I was a bit scared because I liked her working in the office. But that was her decision.
It's really a shift from me to us as a unit.
Yes, you become a team.
Yeah.
And even, you know, when raising kids, that's your role in the mission. That's your role in the mission. I think that's really important.
Yeah.
The next thing, and you'll know this from studying John DeMartini, and I think it's vital, is understanding the values of your partner.
Yeah.
So we all have very different values, and we all see things in a very different way. Now, I know there's the sort of the jovial things that men are from Mars or women are from Venus and that kind of stuff. But actually, everyone's different and everyone has a different set of values. Mm-hmm. So taking time and caring and considering enough to ask your partner what's most important to you in your life, and you know, how can I help you get your needs met?
Yep.
I think that's really important. I think that for a while, so probably for the latter 3 or 4 years of my relationship with my wife, to be honest, we kind of just, in a very convenient and satisfied way, lived in a bit of a parallel universe.
Yeah.
She was happy cracking on doing the kids. She likes her own space. Yep. She likes to be on her own. She's very independent. She lived in this world. I was, you know, doing my mission, writing my books, doing a lot of stuff. I lived in this world.
Yeah.
And to be at some point, we kind of got too much living in a parallel universe, but not together.
Yeah.
So then we had to actually make plans to date night, go out for dinner, have a breakfast with the kids on a Saturday or a Sunday out at Bill's, have a weekly or a two-weekly like family meeting and actually compartmentalize in time to do things. Because when you're an entrepreneur, there's always another sale that needs to be done, another email that needs to be answered. And before you know it, you could be lost. 3 or 5 years and you haven't really seen much of your partner. I'm not into all this when people say, oh, well, you know, I'm working and I've got to work and I've got to put food and money on the table and this is what I want to do and you're with me or you're with me or you're not or you're not. Yeah. I don't respect and admire that as a trait. I think that's too self-absorbed. Yeah. I think, you know, everyone needs a good partner, whether it's a wife or a husband or an ops manager or a joint venture partner.
Yeah.
So I think considering their needs is really important.
And so just on that, a big, big thing I see with a lot of fitness entrepreneurs is when they start to build their business and they start to grow, you might have seen it in your industry, but what they tend to do is they tend to expect the wife or the other half to be at the same speed that they're at and to be a carbon copy of that. But when you dissect it and look at it, they just want, you know, the wife to support what they're doing to fuel their own mission. And again, it's the I thing, it's not the us thing, and it's very much self-centered. And then that's when somebody then gets really pissed off and goes their separate ways. So,
and you can't blame someone for feeling a bit miffed or frustrated or lost if you've pivoted and you've gone on this massive new direction. And people forget that.
Yeah.
I know it's easy to say, hey, look, if you love me, you love me. But you could say it the other way around. Well, if you love me. And I think so when you're going to embark in a change, a career change, a lifestyle change, or if you're going to work extra hard, David Goggins said something to me when I interviewed him on my podcast. And he said, my fiance, I think she gets what I'm like.
Yeah.
And she knows I'm with her.
Mm.
But every now and again, I sit her down. Sorry, you're going to have to be my fiance at this point, Phil. and every now and again, he'll sit down with his fiance and he'll say, you know, I've got to go do this, honey.
Yeah.
So I'm going to be gone for a bit because I've just got to get this done.
Yeah.
I know you'll wait for me.
Yeah.
I love you very much, but I've got to go and do this thing.
Yeah.
Will you let me go do this thing?
Yeah.
I've got to focus over, you know, like a 200 mile run or something like that.
Yeah.
And communicating, I was going to say communication, but if I'd have said it too early, people would have thought, oh, that's a cop-out answer. Or that's a bit cheesy. But actually, if you feel frustrated or maybe undermined, find the right way to communicate it non-emotionally.
Very much so, yeah.
And if you've got to go and do something, don't assume that your partner knows what you're doing and where you're doing it and why you're doing it. So explain to them, look, I'd love to do this. Yeah. Are you on board? And also, what can I do for you?
Yeah.
So,
and I think you know, a really good point on that is, again, like communicating as objectively as possible, but like avoiding triggered communication is massive. We have, me and my wife, every morning, we have like a huddle. So like, what's your outcome for today? What's my outcome for today? Is there anything you need from me today? Vice versa. And like that sets the, like, you know, the relationship off on a very strong footing.
Yeah.
And like, we've built a routine with that. And then at the end of the day, like, you know, is there anything today that you learned about yourself? You know, it's like a little bit of just good quality questioning, you know? And,
that's really sweet. You have a huddle every morning.
A little huddle.
No, it's reality. That's really sweet. So here's something interesting that we should talk about. And that is, I read on Arianna Huffington's page, about the when you get triggered.
Yeah.
So we all know how we feel when we get triggered.
Mm.
An emotional flooding or hijacking in our body, whether it's anger, envy, resentment, bitterness, pain, shame, vulnerability, whatever, all those emotions that are strong. And they're triggered from past experiences and memories of what's happened to us before. And this this moment in the current situation has triggered a flooding of the emotions. And that apparently lasts about 90 seconds. And I thought about this and I read this. And that's why they say, you know, don't reply to an email straight away or go and have a walk if you're feeling really emotional. Because in if you think about it...
Sometimes you can only go on so many walks.
Well, that's true.
you can't walk any further.
Yeah, that's very true. But I reckon a lot of people are fucking up their life in those 90 seconds because I think they're writing emails and, you know, getting angry or defensive or critical or arguing or whatever it is in those 90 seconds. And so I'm trying to create this rule for myself. I'm not a perfect human being and I have all the emotions that every human being has. So that means anger, jealousy, bitterness, resentment. You know, they rear their head from time to time. I don't like that about myself. I try and manage that because I don't want to be like that. But they're a human emotion. So they have a function and a purpose. So I also know that about myself. But what I'm trying to do when I get triggered is nothing for 90 seconds. Don't say anything. Don't do anything. Don't write anything. Smile, walk away, breathe, whatever. Because we've all sent that email or said that thing in anger. There's this really...
Or even, you know, like gone and purchased something.
Yeah, emotional spending. because, you've done things out like especially depression or anxiety.
Especially when you're younger. Like,
fill your own voice.
If I don't buy this now, I'm making a fool of myself. Yeah. If I buy this now...
Fear of missing out.
Exactly.
All of these emotions.
I think, you know, that a really powerful quote that stood out for me, and it's always stayed in my brain since, is your thoughts are not reality. Reality is not your thoughts. And in those moments, I mean, it could be something like somebody texting you, like a client saying, are you free for a call? A client pulls out. Those kind of situations can be quite triggering. And sometimes when we're in the middle of those things, we can then ignore it and then go and dip on social media and look at this fantasy land and then massively minimize ourselves. So if I'm in that situation, I'll ask myself really good questions. The first thing I'll say is an affirmation like that, just to get my brain right. And I'll ask, right, what is this teaching you? What can you do? What can you control? What can you not control? And I'll optimize my environment. I'll not, if I've got a really stressful situation, I'll just focus on the biggest priority action step that I can do. And I just got to work on that. I think it's one thing that I can do right now to fix it. If it's something that I have to wait for a response, what can I do in the meantime to make sure that money's still coming in, I'm healthy, and the people that matter to me are safe? So again, like that could be open context depending on what it is, but it's having good internal frameworks and questioning to get yourself out of the emotional state, because when you're really emotional, the intelligence is low.
And that, by the way, that also accounts for high, when you're emotionally high. I've made some of the worst decisions in my life when I've been emotionally high. People assume it's just the depth, don't they?
The most chaotic events in my life, the biggest tragedies, have been brought about by resting on my laurels.
When you think everything is going well.
I've thought things have been going really well. I've thought I've had my shit together. And then all of a sudden, something's crept from under the rug that I've been complacent with. So, you know, a question that I ask myself at the end of the day is, you know, how did whatever you perceive negative or positive today serve you? And how can you get, like, how can I get myself back and centered? So if I have something really positive, if I make a huge big sale, I go, right, what are the downsides? I go, okay, if something's really bad happened, what is that teaching you? Well, don't do that again. Speak to that person. You need to do more of this before you do that. So I think, I can't remember who said the quote, but a life well inspected or a life well studied isn't worth living. So I'm massive into, you know, at the end of my day going, right, what was the biggest lesson today? What went well, what didn't, like, what did you learn? Like, all those kind of things, they may sound wishy-washy. And I think a lot of people journal for the sake of journaling because everyone else is doing it. But I'm trying to do it with a really strong intent to sharpen my mission and make me love myself more. I think that's the most important thing, because if you don't love yourself and you're trying to build something around it, it's just a never-ending, like, really unfulfilling, despairing, like, mission. And you know, if you love yourself and you know that you can continue to operate, that's a very powerful thing. And I think that sounds really wishy-washy, but I think you'd be on agreement with that. When you love yourself and you accept yourself for who you are and you're open to learning, you don't it takes a lot to hold you down. And and even if you are held down with a particular situation, again, it's asking yourself those questions to get out of it. And I think that that's something that has to be trained and conditioned. I don't think that everybody has that unique ability to snap out of things. You know, if it, like a tragedy happened now in my life, I'd be far better prepared to deal with whatever it was compared to when I was 20, 22 years of age emotionally. Do you know what I mean? And I think that gets sharper and sharper. So if you're sharpening those emotional muscles and building them, you're going to be able to handle chaos a lot better.
Mm.
And if you're going to grow a big business or you're going to grow a big mission, you're going to have a lot of challenges. You're going to have friends that, well, once your friend betray you, you're going to look down on you. You're going to have tax. You're going to have more things you need to get involved with, more projects and everything else. It's going to require more time. You're going to piss people off. You're going to have to move things. You're going to have to remodel. You might have to take a dip for a while. These are all challenges that are ultimately going to grow you. And, you know, your success is in direct proportion to the amount of challenge and ridicule that you can contend with to a degree.
Mm.
You know, and I think that's a big, big thing to realize. It's almost like an automatic filter in my head, and I try to teach it to everybody that I work with, is that when you feel that challenge or that gap, that's the thing you need to lean into and just like scrum into it and just get on with it. You know, it's very easy to step back and say you're overwhelmed, you don't know what to do. Successful people I have found, they do two things. They ask for help, and they take action no matter what. It's those two things. Unsuccessful people just sit there, complain, and look at somebody else that's successful and try to justify why they have it. They come up with all sorts of excuses to try to make themselves feel better. And I see that all the time in the fitness industry. And you probably see it yourself.
Mm. Yeah, I think your ability to take on more levels of rejection every day will help you grow. I think your ability not to take yourself too seriously.
That's a big one. And I think that's something that is trained over time. I don't think that can come immediately. Some people have it from the start.
You keep saying here, though, don't you take action.
Yeah.
So I don't think you need to caveat the statement at the end of the day.
Yeah.
But like with rejection, for example, you can develop a thicker skin, I believe. Mm.
Yep.
The only way I believe you can develop a thicker skin is by to take rejected. More level of rejection. The paradox is, no matter how much rejection you get, there'll always be a level where it would hurt.
Mm.
So, you know, when I see online critics and trolls, that would have ruined my weekend if I'd have seen that on Facebook 10 years ago. And I'd have just like really struggled to deal with one person online saying stuff about me because everyone else can see, are they judging me? Am I losing business?
I think that's the big thing. You're worried about other people seeing that person criticize you, and you're worried about the whole impression rather, and then you're focusing on the minute.
Well, yeah, because at that time I'm only looking at downside. Yep, exactly. If I was looking at upside, I could respond in an elegant way and people would go, wow, Rob handles critics pretty well online, and I would have won some fans over. But I couldn't see that back then because I didn't have the wisdom.
Yeah.
But my point is, I could have 1,000 people do that now and it wouldn't bother me. Let's say Arnold Schwarzenegger was in this room and I pitched him something or asked him something and he rejected me, I'd probably feel some pain because that's another level because I look up to him.
Yeah.
So I have found in my life, I have got way better at taking rejection and I've built these layers of thicker skin, but there's still a bigger layer. There's still another layer.
There's still a
bigger level.
And that could be on an individual basis or a group basis.
Yeah.
You know?
Or all of a sudden you go viral or all of a sudden you have quite a lot of followers or you have a big campaign against you and you might have been able to handle it from any individual.
Yeah.
But when it's a campaign against with a load of people.
It's extreme,
So my point is this, and it's agreeing with your point, you have to take action. So if you want to grow and develop and be strong and grow your business, you have to accept rejection every single day. You have to put yourself in that place of uncomfort.
Yeah.
But there's this delusion that people think that, oh, well, when I made $1 million or, you know, when I've got all the clients that I want, everything will be perfect and sorted.
It gets more complicated.
Well, you just get bigger challenges.
Yeah.
Your reward for success is bigger problems to deal with. That is your reward. Okay. It is money. It is fame. It is recognition. It is reward. Mm-hmm. But it is also bigger fucking problems.
Yeah.
I had a £258,000 bill I had to pay out my personal current account. Now, most people don't keep that sort of money in their current account. Most people don't have that amount of money full stop. And I had a bill I had to pay out of my current account.
Mm.
And at first I felt quite shit about that. And now I can just brag that it's my biggest ever bill out of my current account.
Yep.
But the point is, I've had my biggest year this year in business. We're 42% up, we'll hit 20 million for our training businesses. And yet I've had my biggest personal bill. I've had all sorts of other challenges that I won't bore you with.
Mm.
I made a decision on January the 2nd that I was going to have the biggest year of my life. I just made a decision. It was done. I was naive to the challenges it would bring.
Yep.
And I don't beat myself up for that, because if you're running a business in your 12th year and you've never run a business for 12 years, so your 12th year is a whole new experience because you've never done it before.
Mm-hmm.
All the 11 years in business I've learned and got all the lessons and everything else still didn't prepare me for my biggest year yet.
Oh.
Because the challenges that we faced, like I said, I won't bore you with them, they were ones I could never have predicted unless I've been in business 35 years.
Yeah.
So no matter how much experience you get and no matter what level you get to, there is always a new challenger on the horizon. Yep. And the people who are struggling the most are the people who are walking away from their challenges or running from their challenges or hoping their challenges away or burying their heads in the sand or thinking that they can get to a position in their life where there aren't any.
Yeah.
But in reality, there are just new ones.
Yep.
Now, we've got two guys here who did bodybuilding, and you'll know diminishing law of returns or the plateau effect. The more you train and the more you work out, the smaller incremental increments of progress you get over time.
Yeah.
And I think you just have to remember these things and just go and seek them out with a...
Massively, yeah. I mean, I think it's a combination of when people don't take action, it's either not knowing what to do, not having the confidence, or knowing what to do, but being scared of losing something. So losing energy.
Or how other people might perceive them doing it.
And failing. I mean, I think that's a big, big thing with environment as well. And you are going to outgrow people as you grow your business. And that sometimes includes members of your family. There's sometimes you have to put members of your family on mute. I had to do that with my family for a period of years.
On mute, I like that. I'm normally a little bit more direct than saying putting them on mute. I'm a big believer in the constantly putting yourself out there and challenging your weaknesses and your vulnerabilities.
Yeah.
But something I want to come back to that we talked about earlier, because I don't think we've probably addressed it, is going from one man band to business owner. And you talked a lot about, well, you've got to delegate. And I said that actually you want to think about getting yourself out the business as quick as possible. And I want to bust a few myths in people's head. So people commonly think, and you said these, Phil, no one will be able to do my business better than me.
Yeah.
That's actually not true at all. There are better PTs than you, there are better lifters than you, there are better coaches than you. Your ego won't like it, but there are.
Yep.
So you could actually hire better coaches than you.
Yep, 100%.
Number one, there are better marketers than you, there are better salespeople than you. So you're not the best person for the job you just think you are. The second thing you worry about is, oh, well, maybe my clients, you know, they won't go to another coach or trainer or like I said, you can get a better one.
And they're interested in the results.
Exactly. They don't really care the face.
If you can articulate that properly, you know, I'm taking on a coach. They know my exact process. You know, I know what I'm talking about, but I'm also going to be here to see it off. And every now and again, like, you know, and then they dissolve it over time.
Yeah.
You know, that I think sometimes people want things to be done tomorrow and some things have to be more physic in nature and just have to happen over time. But for sure, definitely.
So, I mean, there was a time probably 5 or 6 years ago when I was doing all of the speaking gigs for my companies.
Yeah.
So you've just been over there doing our Property Investing Masterclass, haven't you? Investing in yourself, which I really respect and admire. And so we have about 3 trainers that run that course. It's a 4-day course. I used to run all 4 days of that course. Right. Every single minute of every single day. And go out for dinner.
How did you find letting go with that?
Well,
initially in the stages where, like, one, like, where were you mentally when you wanted to let go of that? And two, what was it initially like letting go?
Right. So where I was mentally was really fatigued.
Yeah.
Because I'd done 250 odd speaking gigs that year. And when I do a speaking gig, it's not 90 minutes, it's a day.
Yeah.
And I do long days. So my voice started to go. You can hear I've still got a kind of a croaky voice. I had 2 out-of-body experiences when I was doing public speaking. One was when I broke the world record for the longest public speech. Actually saw myself come out of my own body and troll myself in front of myself. What the fuck are you talking about? Who the fuck do you... Yeah, yeah, because I did so much of it. So I know I just said earlier, when you're doing what you love, you don't get burnout.
Yeah.
But when you do so much of what you love, I think I had fatigue would be...
Fatigue, physically.
Exactly. Yeah. So that was actually the trigger. Because here's the thing, if you know, if someone got diabetes and they had to have an operation, they're out for 6 months, they'd figure out a way for someone to take over their business, look after their clients, call them up and all of that. So where I was I was kind of forced to let go because I couldn't do any more public speaking. I was burning myself out.
And I think sometimes you have to reach that point of rock bottom.
You do, but we can tell people that you don't.
Yeah.
Because I think a lot of people, they reach that point before they go, okay, I'll let go, I'll hire someone, I'll give someone my baby, because they've got no other choice.
Yeah.
So what I'm saying is, don't get yourself to that point.
Don't get yourself
there. I know your question was, you know, at what point did you get to before you did it?
Yep.
My point is saying, don't get to my point before you do it.
Yeah, don't get it. Yep.
So
it's almost like a wisdom thing, you know, in the sense of, look, I've been there. I know what it feels like. I can recognize the signs, the symptoms. Do this whenever you feel like that.
Start it now. But I think the thing is, the pain isn't there yet. when you're training and you can do 5, 6, 7, maybe even 10 clients a day, whatever you can do, and the money's coming in, there's no pain.
Yep.
Now, if you knew you were going for an operation in 3 months
yep.
and you couldn't personal train for 6 months, yep. the pain's there.
Yep.
So
you'd be forced to get creative. You're forced to
You've got a plan. Just make a plan.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, yep.
So there was two ways we did it. One was wrong, one was right. So the first thing was I kind of burned out from doing 250 speaking gigs.
Yep.
In 1 year. I've been saying for 2 years, I'm going to train trainers, I'm going to bring you through, I'm going to give you stages. I created a train the trainer program, a train the trainer ascension plan. I recorded every talk, I wrote their slides, their scripts, I'd done all the assets for them, but I didn't get out of the way because I loved the speaking too much.
Yeah.
And it was like, everyone likes Rob and Rob, and my ego loved a bit of everyone likes Rob.
I think it's a part of like, if I let go of this, the business is going
to
go down.
Yeah, but the reality was, we probably went from 2 or 3 million to 20 million because we have trainers, and we wouldn't be at 20 million if it was just me. We could only ever be at 2 or 3 million because I can only do a certain amount of days a year. So the burnout forced me to let go.
Yep.
But then the big shift, and I can't remember where I'd read this, but I'd read this in a book because, like yourself, I read a lot of books.
Yep.
And it said something like, if you can't be out of your business for, I think it was 30 days or 90 days, then you don't have a proper business. Then you just have a job, but you own the company.
Yep.
So I thought, screw this, I'll try it. And we booked a mentorship in Cayman. So we sold a mentorship, a property mastermind mentorship, and we decided to do it in Cayman Islands because we had a client who used to fly us to Cayman Islands.
Yep.
And then we thought, well, we could go back next year and actually run a mentoring for like 10 people around the boardroom. We'll hire a villa. We hired a £40,000 villa for 3 weeks. We sold two tables of 10 1 week. 1 week at the start, we had a week's holiday, 1 week at the end.
Yep.
So we were all in to do that trip. Yep. It was like 9 or 10 months away.
Yep.
And both Mark and I, my business partner, we were going.
Yeah.
So we now had 10 months.
To make it happen.
To make it happen.
Yeah.
And that's what we did. And it's actually not that hard. You write the systems and processes.
Yep.
You record anything you can record, like any exercise or anything you record.
Yep.
You write a little manual for your health and safety and your protocols and your processes and your brand and what's unique. You set up your online booking system. You set up your WhatsApp groups. You have someone taking the calls.
Yep.
Bit by bit, everything that you do, you can give to someone else.
Yep.
Like, it's not rocket science.
And I think it's like, you know, the spending of money on it, the thing you're going to lose money, it's the money that actually comes from that as well.
Yeah.
It's massively because, you know,
you have to let go to grow. And I think that's,
I've had to realize as well, like, you know, back then it's, you're the only volatility in the company. And, you know, realistically, if you break, then everything breaks if you haven't passed that stuff over. And I mean, that leads me to a question that I have.
Yeah, we've got five minutes. So maybe let's do
three. Well, let's say three lessons for building a great team, for delegating and building a great team. We covered one, like document everything, make sure it's really, really clear and pass it off. But what about the, just managing people, because that's always something you hear somebody complain about, is managing people's a nightmare, managing a team's a nightmare. Let's talk about like the emotional side of people and how to get them on your vision and aligned. How, like, how, what lessons could you share for that?
So I think the first thing is, no matter how small you are, create a vision.
Yeah.
Make it disruptive, make it exciting, make it non-corporate. You know, make it something that people would want to come and work towards.
Because I think that's a big, big thing.
Yeah, because when you're small, you don't do that.
Yeah,
you think big companies do it, but one-man, two-man bands, they often don't do that.
Yeah, and like you've that's obviously a big thread in your mission, is about being disruptive and not doing the corporate stuff. Is that out of your frustration of seeing so many people think that that's going to be successful? Why is that?
Honestly, it's just really my personality.
Right.
So I'm not like anti-corporate. I've never really worked. I mean, I've worked in a couple of jobs that weren't my family or my own company, but only a couple of small ones. I'm not actually properly anti-establishment or anti-corporate.
Yeah.
I mean, I have a lot of people come and work here who realize we're friendly, we're open, we're accessible, we have fun, we don't wear uniform. You can come and speak to the owner of the company, you can take the piss out of him, he'll take feedback. We're forgiving of mistakes, all those things that a lot of corporations are not.
Yeah.
So I think that's the second question. So the first thing is creating a really exciting, disruptive, unique vision that people will support you on and buy into. Because it doesn't matter how big you are if that's exciting. Mm-hmm. It's not about where you are, it's about where you're going.
Yep.
I think the second thing is the unique culture.
Yep.
Why come and work for me? Why leave your safe job at Virgin Active or whatever to come and be, sorry about that, it could have been David Lloyd, it could have been, I wasn't a stab at them, but you know, even though Kieran left Virgin Active to come here. but my point is, why go and, because that job is safer.
Yeah.
People who've left big companies and worked for me, they've left a safer job than when I was starting out. So it's the culture, i.e. the people, the feeling, the environment, the mission, the energy, the enthusiasm, the passion, etc. I think that's the second thing. I think the third thing is actually making sure that you hire good people.
Yeah.
And sometimes when you really need to hire someone, you'll hire someone rather than the right person. Yeah. I think it's having a good job description, a good job
ad. A mixture of attitude and technical ability as well.
Yeah, yeah. A lot of people say, oh, hire, they say, should you hire on attitude or experience? Well, I actually think it depends. Mm. If you're hiring someone in training in an apprentice role, then it's attitude all day long.
Yep.
If you're hiring a coder,
a highly specialist guy,
then it's not about attitude at all. It's about technical. And people get this wrong. It's like, lock the guy in a room. All right, he might be grumpy. He might not have very good social skills. Lock him in a fucking room and let him do his job.
Because
he's the best at the job. So I'm a big fan of people who are the best at the job.
Yeah.
But of course, attitude is nice too.
Yeah.
But it depends on the role.
Yeah. Massive.
And then I think open communication is next. So I think you've got to know when to give someone feedback, i.e. they need to improve.
Yeah.
You've got to know when to support them and lift them up when they're challenged.
Yeah.
You've got to
just communicating out in the right way rather than barking. Again, it's thinking long vision in terms of, right, if I do this now, it could cause a... You know, it's a chip on the shoulder that can carry into the whole rest of the team.
Well, I actually think giving feedback is more about when you say it, not what you say.
Yeah.
And many times I have said the right thing at the wrong time. So, for example, I'll leave a lot of feedback now for my team in the one-to-ones where I sit down, where there's a part where I can give them their feedback instead of going pew, when it happened in the moment.
Yeah.
Golden rule, after I've only done this twice in 12 years.
Yep.
Once was actually 2 weeks ago, so I kind of a bit annoyed with myself about it, but it was only in front of four people, and then once was about 5 years ago. But only twice in 12 years have I shot anyone down in public.
Oh, wow.
And I'm proud of that because, you know, like, people piss me off every day.
Yep.
People upset me every day. People screw me over every day. People wrong me every day, in my own perception, of course.
Yeah.
And of course, I don't want to go and...
Love it.
I want to go and let them know that.
Yeah.
And only twice in 12 years have I lost my shit.
Yep.
In front of people. I don't mind. I don't mind pushing back one to one.
Yeah.
If we've got beef, we'll have a discussion and I'll push back if I need to.
Yeah.
But if I lose my shit to you in front of people, I'm the idiot, not you.
Yeah.
And I've done it twice. And I think twice in 12 years, that's not a bad record. Because you never win doing that.
Yeah.
In fact, I've done that and turned.
But it needed to happen in order for you to realise it.
Well, there you go. And by the way, when
I did
you
gotta
that,
flip it.
Well, when I did that, the guy that I did it to left and nicked three of our staff and set up a competing business. So, now, that wasn't the only thing, but that, I know, was the straw that broke the camel's back.
Yeah.
So that was a lesson I needed to get, and that was one of the best things that happened to me, upside in the downside.
Yeah.
Because had that not happened, I might do it now. In front of 85 staff.
He might have done it at a different time when you know. Yeah. Again, you gotta look, it's fine, and there's a little intricate.
Yeah.
Love it. So, I mean, on top of that as well, like, I've got another question here, and this is for any entrepreneur, especially the business guys that all of a sudden embrace marketing and sales and get a lot better and start earning a lot more money. And I think this is a big thing that's overlooked by so many people is, you know, more money, often more problems. And one of those big problems when trying to scale a business is tax.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of fitness entrepreneurs that we help that grow.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden they hit that threshold.
Yeah.
All of a sudden they hit higher tax brackets.
Yeah.
How have you overcome the mental barrier of doing that?
Okay,
because a lot of people are scared to go over that. They creep underneath it. You know how it goes.
Yeah, right. There's a lot of it. Lot of things at play here. I'll try and answer them quickly. So, when people say more money, more problems, I disagree. More money for me, different problems, and that is a really key distinction.
Yep.
Because when you make money and you go, oh, I remember when I was had less money and there were less problems. No, you've just forgotten the problems you had when you were skin.
Yeah.
When I was skin, I was going out with a girl and she had to pay for me for everything for about 6 months because I was skin. And I was absolutely shamed and embarrassed by that I couldn't even pay for my girlfriend for dinner.
Yeah.
And she didn't mind doing it.
Yeah.
But I felt shamed by that a man can't even pay his way.
Yeah.
So, all right, I've got a £250,000 Lamborghini that I just had to pay £5,000 for a service. I've got a £125,000 Ferrari that I paid £2,500 for a repair. I've got a Range Rover, £100,000 Range Rover. The engine blew and it cost me £12,000.
What? Range Rovers do that all the time.
What's happened to the Lamborghini?
My Lamborghini broke down in the middle of the road. And it was there for like nine hours.
Did you get abuse at the same?
Yeah, we've got videos, mate. We've got videos. I've got so much abuse. So yes, I have problems. I mean, insuring me on my cars is £3,500 to £4,000 per car.
Yeah.
But they are first world problems and I'm fully aware of that. And I say that jovially because I'm grateful for all that. So when people say more money, more problems, I disagree.
Mm-hmm.
More money, different problems. Mm-hmm. But for me, more money, better quality problems.
Yeah.
I'd rather have, I've got to pay £5,000 to fix my Lamborghini than I can't even pay for dinner with my girlfriend.
Yeah.
By the way, about We split up, and about a year later, when I made some money, I wrote a check. I worked out all the dinners I thought she'd ever paid for me, and I wrote a check and I posted it to her.
What?
I know, because that was like the releasing of my shame.
Right,
it was
for
me, it wasn't for her. I don't even know if she cashed it, and I don't even care. So next to tax then. Like, VAT is just an illusion in people's mind. People think that they add the VAT on top, people won't buy their services, but that's not true, because you can actually claim VAT back the other way. Mm-hmm. So yeah, if you charge VAT, then people have to pay VAT, but you can also claim VAT back once your VAT registered on all the things that you buy, and they can claim VAT back. People usually don't turn down a service if it's good, if it's 20% more.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so if a personal trainer is charging 40 quid and the session's good, people probably won't turn it down at 48.
48,
because they probably won't. I also think, look at it another way, because you and I both believe there's an upside in every downside and a downside in every upside.
Of course,
that's one
of
the things that have come out. So people can say, oh, I'm VAT registered, I've got to charge more. But a lot of people go, you're not VAT registered, you're not a proper business then. Because to me, if someone's not VAT registered,
legit,
they haven't even taken 70 grand.
Yeah.
So they're not a proper business.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
I'm not going to risk my money on them, because they could go bust very quickly because they're not a proper business.
Yeah.
They haven't got any money in the bank if they're not yet VAT registered. So it's just a mindset thing.
And also the fact that you're going to work harder, you're going to look at refining things and probably take things a lot more serious.
Yeah. Because you're a real business.
Exactly. You know, if you've already got to that, then like when you start leaning in a little bit, you're going to go further. So
next thing is, I just do not get the mindset where people are like, oh, well, I don't want to earn too much money in case I have to pay too much tax. Well, the reality is you only pay tax on what you've earned.
Yeah.
So, okay, you're paying tax.
People get confused about it being an actual, like, it's bringing your wealth down, where it's an actual, like, you know.
It's relative.
It's relative,
so, you get certain thresholds, where under a certain threshold you go over and the tax jumps. But the reality is, the more money
it's not a cost per se. It's almost like, but it is an expense.
But it's not a cost of sale, but if you see it as a cost of sale, it's an operational cost of doing business and growing, it's better than thinking, oh, I don't want to be paying all this tax.
Yeah.
But,
and that's where emotional management of, like, you know, looking after your emotions and spending properly, investing, ROI, you know, making sure that you're getting money back out of the things that you put money in. That's exactly, you know, why I came on one of your courses, to put money into property to create infrastructure.
Which is an offsetable business expense.
Exactly.
So this was going to be my next point.
Exactly.
If you can go on the HMRC website and you can look at pretty much every single thing that's an offsetable, legitimate business expense.
Mm-hmm.
And you can expense a lot of things against your company that you don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Keep a logbook of all your mileage, all the places you go when you go to your clients. Obviously, all the equipment that you use, the clothing.
Yep.
Like, this is a Vivienne Westwood jacket. I cannot put this through the business, unfortunately. But if I lob Disruptive on it,
if
I put Disruptive on the back of this, this £1,000 jacket would be an offsetable business expense. Because I've looked at it, I'll put legit on it. So all the t-shirt, I mean, it's my brand anyway, Disruptive.
Vivienne Westwood too, is it?
Did you just want to touch my pecs? Is that what it was?
I think it's about being properly educated.
Yeah, the expos you go to, the education you have. Most things, I mean, a PT doesn't have much overhead. Let's be honest, they don't have much overhead. And if you have like a little gym in your garage, you can run that through.
Yep.
All the equipment that you buy and the depreciation can be run through.
Yep.
So actually, if you're smart and you run all the things through that you can run, then you might pay more tax because you're earning more money, but then you'll pay a lot less tax.
Yeah. And I think it just comes with lack of education
and
probably having a good accountant. Again, delegation. You know, a lot of people just try to guess that, leave it to the last minute. But when you are running a business, you've got responsibilities and duties to make sure that stuff like that is in order, because that's the lifeblood of your business at the end of the day.
I mean, if you're smart, for example, let's say you go to London, you like going shopping. I love going down Bond Street. It's my favorite street. I love going to Alexander McQueen. Well, if I merged that with a seminar in the evening, now I have got a good portion of that time that's an offsetable business expense.
Yeah.
So if you're smart with your time, you go on holidays, you go to fitness expos and you do a speech out there.
Yep.
Now, a good part of that holiday, now I have to be really clear, you can't lie about what you're doing, but if you go and stay for a week and go to a fitness expo for a couple of days and you go and do a few meetings and stuff like that, all the subsistence for that is offsetable.
Yep.
And you've kind of merged it in with a trip.
Yep.
So, I mean, a lot of your clothing.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Just being mindful of that too. Yeah. 100% for sure.
All right, cool. I think we're just about done.
Awesome.
I don't want to kick you off, but I'm interviewing the CEO of Netflix next.
Yes.
Yeah.
Important individual.
So I'm punching above my weight twice today. Anything you want to say to finish off? Well, why don't we let people know a bit more about us just quickly and where they can find our work? Because we haven't done that, because some of my followers all know you and vice versa.
I run a fitness podcast on iTunes and Spotify called the Fitness Entrepreneur Podcast. It's all about how fitness business owners can create money, impact, and freedom. There are a lot of normal businesses that listen to it as well. Businesses
will this go on that podcast?
Yep, it sure will. So we'll repurpose it, leverage.
Okay.
And you can find me at phil-graham.com. And for the diabetes things, you can find on Amazon the Diabetic Muscle and Fitness Guide. Diabeticmuscleandfitness.com is where we have our big community. And also Instagram and all the usual outlets, YouTube and everything else. So
and your handles are what? Just Phil Graham?
PhilGraham01. If you just search Phil Graham, it'll come up straight away. And the primary focus of our work is really helping fitness business owners simplify and scale. Gym owners, personal trainers, online coaches, and also as well, lead an inspiring life. I think that's a big, big focus of ours. It differentiates us, is really looking at building a great life with the business, not just the business. It has to merge in between. So, yeah. And what about yourself?
So, Disruptive Entrepreneur is my podcast. Yeah, there you go. Disruptive Entrepreneur is my podcast. You can find me on Amazon. Search my name, Rob Moore. Money, Life, Leverage, Start Now, Get Perfect Later, I'm Worth More. I've written a few books. And then, my handles are Rob Moore Progressive on Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, LinkedIn, etc.
Yep.
So go and have a little play with whatever you want that I have put out online. Awesome.
And I just want to say a massive thank you for having
pleasure.
Me on. You are doing great work in the field, and I know
how. Love the AP, Phil.
I know how much work goes into all this, and how many lessons as well over the years. So I appreciate all the lessons, and I'm an avid student, my man.
Thank you.
Thank you very, very
thanks
much.
Thanks for coming here today.